you have questions about digital photography, you've come to the right place. Welcome to Photo Focus. Here's your host, Scott Bourne.
Welcome to another edition of Photo Focus. So glad you're here. Our first show of 2012, brought to you by my good friends at ViewBug. ViewBug.com is the place to go if you want to participate in some very cool photo contests. Check them out, V-I-E-W-B-U-G.com. There's also a link on the Photo Focus site. Today, I can't think of any way to start 2012 better than to start it with Tamara Lackey. Tamara is back on the show. Hi, Tamara.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's by popular demand, I assure you. We kind of have a little bit of a change in the Photo Focus podcast. We're just going to have a little convo first, and then we're going to answer a few questions. We're trying to change it up because we did, I don't know, 97 shows where we answered questions, nothing but questions, and it dawned on me that I think we've pretty much covered it.
There is no more possible question left on the planet.
Before we do go on, Tamara, I know that you just spent what amounts to their summer, most of our first part of winter, down in Australia, I believe.
Yes, Australia and New Zealand.
Tell us about the photo ops you had down there.
Oh, yeah, kind of ridiculous, actually. I went down to do some workshops in Australia, and we ended up traveling by car from Sydney down to Melbourne, and just taking in the whole road down is just, you know, unbelievable natural beauty. And it's interesting, too, because obviously the photo opportunities are stunning between not just the natural beauty, but the architecture. Like Melbourne is – every time I say Melbourne, I'm reminded that it's Melbourne. Melbourne has – it's like walking through a kid's book. There's just – you know, everything's so bright and shiny and so much emphasis on art and sculpture everywhere.
Yeah.
It was really lovely. And then we ended up camper vanning through the South Island of New Zealand for a few weeks, and – you know, everybody says how beautiful it is there, but it's kind of like one of those places that until you show up and look, you can't believe how crisp and clean everything is.
So did you see any kangaroos?
I did. I got to see actually a pack of wild kangaroos charging through a graveyard, which was like a total accident. We happened to be getting gas at a gas station, and I said, any chance there's any kangaroos around here? Kind of half joking. He goes, oh, take a left down the street. You'll see hordes of them. which technically is considered a mob. I learned that it's a mob of kangaroos, and we pulled in, and they were just everywhere. And I got a bunch of photographs. I saw several with the joeys, and then I got one step too close, and they all kind of just galloped off, and it was unreal.
Wow! So did you get to take pictures of any?
I did. Yes, I've got quite a few. I'll have to share them with you.
Okay, I definitely want to see him. So what was this, as a photographer, just fairly quickly tell everybody what kind of photography you usually do.
Portrait photography, very, you know, very much focused on children and families, especially, not usually landscape.
Okay, so with that in mind, tell us what the coolest thing that you photographed.
The coolest thing I would say I photographed was, outside of the mob of kangaroos, was probably Milford Sound in the fjordlands of New Zealand. Have you ever been there?
The only place I've been in New Zealand is Auckland about 30 years ago. So I'm definitely not up on my down under stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Milford Sound is it's in the fjordlands area, which is where they filmed all the, Lord of the Rings.
Oh,
so
okay.
So these crazy kind of, you go through these forests and woodsy trees where they really do look like they're alive and talking to you and that they're characters. It was really pretty stunning. But this the sound is basically this unbelievable pool of clear glacier water where these mountains just come right out of the water and they just go everywhere and it's extremely protected. And you kind of go through their very gentle boats or kayaks and see all this just unreal kind of texture and light and these rainbows and waterfalls and fur seals and dolphins. It was remarkable. That was the coolest thing I photographed there.
So wait a minute. Wait just a minute. Did you see any hobbits?
You know, I didn't. We did go through Lake Tiano where they were filming The Hobbit, but I didn't actually see a hobbit.
Okay. Well, I was just checking. I mean, you know, I thought, well, you got the kangaroos in a graveyard, no less. I thought I'd throw that out there.
Yeah, I do have three kids, and they could pass for hobbits.
I bet they had the time of their lives.
They did. They did, actually. I was really impressed with them.
They're going to have great stories to tell at school.
Yes. Probably the best story was my son. We went on a two-day hike, and he was told that everything, you know, you take on the trail, you take out. And that made him very nervous, which means he had to go to the restroom a lot. It was quite interesting. We were like, everything you take in, you take out.
Oh, yeah. Did they kind of like get this look on their face like?
Yeah. Yeah. First world kids, right? So that was a little jarring.
They're like, what do you mean, Mom?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
You mean they got like takeout food here? Not exactly.
No, baby.
Well, listen, as we headed to 2012, what do you think are going to be the trends in portrait photography? I'm going to tell you what I think 2011's trend was, and you tell me if you think I'm right.
Okay.
Strongly, as in completely and utterly blown out highlights, backlit portraits.
Okay, that was the trend?
I mean, come on, look at everybody's I see a lot of portfolios.
Yeah, well, HDR was really still quite big in 2011.
But I'm mostly thinking portraiture.
Okay, but HDR portraiture.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
You think that was pretty big? Okay, I didn't notice that because I was too busy looking at the blown out highlights and all the pictures.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the other thing too, I think that may, that's kind of kicked up a lot in 2011 and I think is going to become even bigger is, unfortunately, this look where everybody finds an action set that works really well for newborns and children as it relates to portraiture, and then you can't quite tell the difference between anybody's photographs. And I think we've always battled this with action sets, but it seems to be coming more like two or three looks over and over and over again. So as opposed to just seeming like an action that's put out there, something where it's quite difficult to differentiate someone's technical style from another's because it's narrowing down to these several looks. And having done several judging contests at the latter part of 2011, I saw this again and again and again, and it kind of bummed me out a little bit.
Well, I think that's where the strongly backlit portraits, where the sun is mostly the story and the person's face just sort of happens to be in the way. I think that's where that came from. Somebody saw a quote-unquote successful photographer with that on their website, and then everybody started copying it. You know, we see it at the end of every PPA or WPPI. The winning portraits are all then replicated and duplicated by studios for the year.
Yeah.
And I think that is an unfortunate thing. What would be a good trend to start in 2012?
A good trend would be following up on the conversation you and I just had on Redefine, which was your very stellar advice to just be you. And I think people hear that all the time and don't know what it means.
You beat me to my own segue.
we'll let you seg, but from my perspective, I really feel like people say, yeah, I am me. But then have you really taken what you need to take, the time and the effort and the actual analysis to figure out what does that mean as it relates to conveying yourself in your art? Because it's one thing to just kind of quote unquote be yourself. It's another thing to realize how that manifests in the way you represent other people.
Yeah, we did a show. I was very honored to agree to your invitation to appear on your wonderful little web TV show called Redefined. Mm-hmm. And you've had some really, really fancy, popular, famous, well-known folks, and then me as a guest. And on the Redefined show, which is out now, as you, when you hear this podcast, the show will be available. Just search Redefined on your favorite search engine. And you throw Tamara's name in there if you want to improve your results. You'll find it. During that time, you asked me, you know, what are some points I think three things people could do moving forward. And one of them is to just be yourself. But I really do want to talk about that a little more at length before we are going to take a few photo questions here at the end of the show. But I do think it's important for photographers to understand that being new is really overrated and being you is what's actually cool. And I think it's all from this standpoint of every generation, mine, yours, and the one we're in now, has got this feeling that they need to be rebels without a cause. You know, we got to be rebellious because that's cool. It's cool to be different. So in my generation, we didn't get haircuts. That was our thing. You know, everybody had a burr haircut except us hippies. We had long hair. That was the way we rebelled. Now they turn the hair purple.
Or, well, actually, if you're 14, it's the Justin Bieber look is still there. You still don't cut your hair.
Okay. Well, whatever. It's ridiculous to me. We try to copy somebody else to prove that we're different. But in any event, I think that what's lost, particularly on new photographers, is that the really great ones in this business are great because they have found a way to bring their own pure, raw, heartfelt emotion to their work. That's the difference. I mean, when you look at photographers whose work you can automatically spot, you know, that's an Ansel Adams shot, or, you know, that's a Dorothea Lange shot. It's usually because they're working from the heart and they don't have to fake it. So it doesn't move from picture to picture. Is that making sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know how the old saying is, my mom used to say, don't tell a lie because then you'll have to remember it.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing goes when you copy photo styles. If you copy one style and then another and you forget, your pictures always look different. But if you just shoot from your heart, it's always going to be consistent.
Absolutely. And, you know, in addition, when you're looking through all those portfolios and you're seeing a bunch of work, there's something delightful about just saying, gosh, who shot this? And, mm-hmm. You know, the idea of you get excited about seeing someone really put themselves into it. And you miss out on that when all you're doing is mimicking. You miss out on the opportunity to even elicit that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And if you just spend time trying to figure out what it is that's important to you, that's how people find out how they're being themselves. If they're spending time on doing the things that they think are truly important, not the things that their peers said they should think are truly important, but the things that they think are truly important, regardless of whether those things are accepted or not, they'll be true to themselves. And that's what becomes new. There's only one Tamara Lackey on this planet. And goodness knows we've all put in our request to get in another one, but it's just been refused over and over. There's only one of you. And so every picture that you make is special and new because it's the one that you made. It's from you. It's your heart. And that's what I want people to understand. And there's only one of you. And so when you make a picture from your heart, it is new. It's brand new.
Yes. Yes. That I think that really resonated, the idea of you versus new.
Anyway, if you want to hear Tamara and I talk about this, and if you want to understand why the phrase "Scott has a face built for radio" was invented, then be sure to watch the Redefined show.
I think the phrase is, wow, look at Scott in a suit and tie.
Well, I had to do something to get people to not look at me, so they look at the suit.
You know, one other interesting thing when you mentioned about, like, because you've had people ask you, like, well, what else do I have to do to be me? Like, I mean, you've had people ask you that, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And like you said, you, that sounds easy enough, be yourself and do what you want kind of thing. But it's the hardest thing in the world because, one of the things I've been asked a lot is a question I ask myself to figure out better, you know, whatever you're talking about. And one of the things I realized is, when you can think about things that in your own personal life, disturb you or frustrate you, or you feel are just wrong. This is one of 5 million ways to look at it. When you can find out what that is and look at the inverse of it and see how you're drawn to that, and how you seek that, that's one way that you're expressing yourself and getting closer to who you are. So although I've profiled some photographers who have amazing work that's very edgy and slick and even angry, and that works for them, that would never – the anger part would never work for me because I don't look for that. I don't seek that. I think that anger is often a Band-Aid for hurt, you know? And yeah. So I'd rather look for hurt and better show that if that's the thing I'm going for. It's that's what I'm saying. It's like ideas like that to really drill down. That's how you start getting those answers that people don't know how to find.
I like that. And I'll piggyback off that and just throw one more thing into that mix for how you know when you found the real you. It's sort of like love. You'll know it when you find it.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, when I started doing bird photography, it was almost a surprise to myself.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm going to do what? I'm going to take pictures of what? And then 15 years later, I found out that that's what I'd done pretty much every day for 15 years.
Isn't that funny? You're like, oh, apparently I'm a bird photographer.
Yeah, apparently that's what I'm supposed to be doing because that's what I just did. And yeah. It's the same as love. you know, you have 1,000 people ask you out on a date and there's one that you just can't get out of your mind, that's the one. You have a kind of photography you can't just get out of your mind, that's the one. So give that a try. Before we move on, I do want to say we're going to welcome 2012 with a great big thank you to my friends at Animoto. Animoto.com is the best place to post your photo slideshows. And what's really good about it is it's all automated. You don't have to know how to do anything, but they'll make it look like you hired a bunch of fancy MTV producers to put your video together. And they incorporate slides, text, and video with music to create a multimedia presentation that's hard to beat. Check them out at Animoto.com. There's a banner on the PhotoFocus.com website you can click on. It'll take you right over to Animoto's site, or just type in Animoto.com. We appreciate their support of PhotoFocus. We're going to talk a little bit about a couple of questions that came into the show, Tamara. Becky wrote to us, and she has some Australian Shepherd dogs. So I thought this would be very appropriate, since you've just been to Australia, where you no doubt ran into Australian Shepherd dogs, right?
Oh, yeah. I became an expert in the breed.
Anyway, she's talking about their auburn color and their highlights and the white and the way it goes around the head. And she can't seem to get a satisfactory image of the dogs without blowing out the highlights. Now, whether we're using this question about dogs, but there are lots of things that have strong highlights in them. And you do want to sometimes consider making sure those don't get blown out. And she's saying that she could adjust it in Photoshop and wants to know if that's the best way to tackle it, or is there anything in camera she can do that will give her a better chance of holding those highlights? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things to consider. First and foremost, I would look to see what her custom functions are, how they're set up. If she's got some sort of contrast boost or something going on that is making it more difficult for her to get a more even capture in terms of her dynamic range. The other thing to consider if she is shooting with either a Canon or a Nikon is that there are additional custom functions set up outside of just how you've kind of maximized the performance of your camera to work for you, which deal completely with highlights. Like with Canon, it's the highlight tone priority, or with Nikon, it's active delighting. And those are features that just help manage the dynamic range and the gradation between the grays and the highlights becomes smoother, and it just becomes an easier way to shoot and manage your highlights if you're finding that you're having issues like that.
That was the perfect answer. Yeah, that was what I was going to say. Look for that feature in your camera, but otherwise you will have to do it, in post, in Photoshop or whatever. In the old days, before most of our listeners were born, Tamara, maybe even before you were born, because I know you're just like, what, 18?
19.
Okay. We had to make a choice. Photography for years is still, in my opinion, is this way, is about compromise. And, you know, in the old days, we're like, well, are we going to hold shadow detail or hold highlight detail? You could, you know, when you had film and 4 stops of latitude, no Photoshop, no scanners, and major prints that way, that was that. You had to make a choice, particularly if you were shooting slide film, because if you overexposed that, it was just clear plastic. I still think we have to some degree decide what's important in the photograph. I mean, are we holding highlights because of the religion of holding highlights? Are we holding highlights because we truly think there's detail there that matters?
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think in many ways we're relearning a lot of that when it comes to iPhone photography. You know, you're having you don't have as many decision points. So you've got to decide where you're holding them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's for some reason, people on a forum would just crash on a photo that has one pixel that's blown out if it was taken with a Canon 5D. But if it's taken with the iPhone, all they say is, hey, great composition. It's funny. Well, decide what's important because, you know, the other thing is the religion of holding the highlights, like all photographic religions, is false. But lately, it's even expanded to specular highlights, which is crazy because specular highlights almost like never in a list of a million times you would take a picture need to have any detail in them. They're specular for that reason. The shiny point of a diamond does not need detail in it. Trust me when I tell you this.
But I think you need detail in the star, in the sky.
Yeah. Okay. Especially that one that's like 12 billion light years away.
That one especially, yes.
And if you ever come up with a lens, Tamara, that will get that detail, I would like to buy it from you. All right. We have a question from Steve Shenicky, that's just a guess, Steve. He was wondering about our thoughts on octobanks for speed lights. He's been reading a lot about the Lastolite, Hot Rod, Octa, and there's a bunch of other different brands. Wants to know what an octobank would is it, what if there's an advantage of an octobank over a large softbox, especially in the speedlight arena. For what some of you may not know what Steve's talking about, I think I do, but I could be wrong too. Recently, David Hobby, the strobist, and a bunch of other people have gone to these little contraptions where they take a bunch of speedlights and they put them in a ring. And then they stick them in some kind of light modifier. So it's not just one flash on your camera. It may be two, three, four, five, how many ever you can get in there. And now there are starting to be some products you can buy that provide the light modifiers. Have you ever messed with any of this stuff, Tamara?
I haven't. I've seen some things. I've certainly seen your monster Octobox.
Yes. Well, that's...
That's different. That's not with a speed light, yeah.
No, that's no speed light.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, I actually currently don't use any speed lights. I'm using all hot lights. But I would say that the main advantage of an octobank is that the catch light appears to be round. And if you want to duplicate the natural environment, last time I checked, sun is still round. So
it is. And I think the other thing too, is that they tend to have a very soft light. Mm-hmm. Soft boxes have soft light, but, I think as it relates to working with speed lights, an exceptionally soft light.
Yeah. Yeah. It tends to be softer, but I'm going to tell you, in my experience, based on what I've seen these things cost, by the time you buy all these strobes and the bracket and the softbox, you will have spent twice as much money as you would have spent if you just went out and bought a monolight and put a freaking softbox on it. Call it a day. You know, people try to get fancy for the sake of getting fancy, but it's not worth it. I like to use the simplest lighting setup I can so that I can set it and forget it, because I want to spend all my time trying to get a good expression for my subject or trying to get the light where I want it. I don't want to think about, you know, what tool I'm using.
Yeah, and I think part of the allure of some of the newer things that are coming out is they allow you to use it with I think even just one speed light. I don't know how much power you get in that, but it depends. Maybe you're shooting. Well, never mind. I was going to make a joke here, but I don't want to offend anybody who's using. Never mind.
Send your emails to Tamara Lackey at tamaralackey.com. I think we answered it. It's generally just going to give you a round softbox that cost you a lot more money than it would if you just bought a monolight. So I would look into an inexpensive monolight. You can get a good quality inexpensive monolight for less than the price of an SB900 flash. So there you go.
There you go.
Do you use a flash, Tamara?
I do, yes. I usually use the Metz flashes. I have Canon speedlights as well, but I usually use the Metz.
You use Metz flashes?
I do.
You're the one?
I'm that one. Well, I met some guy in Cincinnati. He also uses them. No, you know what? I like them because they're more powerful, which also means that I've crashed a few. Whole different matter.
Do they work with TTL?
Yep. And they also work with, obviously you can get it for your model camera. I've got the 58 and the 54. When I use that and I switch back and forth between the Canon speedlight especially a dark venue or something, I really notice the difference in power.
Cool. I'll have to take a look at that if I ever want to go back to a strobe. Before we take the next question, I do want to thank my good friends at Smug Mug, still with us in 2012. Smug Mug is the place to go if you want to sell your photos online. They have a great hosting service for professional photographers. They also, I say this every time because I just don't think people understand how good they are at it, they host video really well. They don't compress the video. They don't steal your rights to the videos. We've held the Photo Focus videos for all of our tutorials there for years, long before they were a sponsor. We've used the product because we think it's good. So check them out at smugmug.com. As usual, you can find a banner at photofocus.com, where we do, by the way, publish free photography advice 7 days a week. Or you can just type in smugmug.com. We appreciate their support of Photo Focus. All right. Now, we have an email here that is relation. It's in relation to another podcast I do called Going Pro. You can find that at goingpro2010or11.com. But it was about displaying prints for sale. And Skip Cohen and I were talking about this a little bit, and I thought I'd throw this out to you, Tamara, because I want to see if you do anything different. Have you, first of all, have you done a gallery show?
I haven't.
Have you hung prints in your studio or sales room to sell?
Oh, of course, yes.
And have you lit them any differently than you would, say, oh, a watermelon in your kitchen?
Having never considered that before, I need to think about it.
Did you put any special lights on the port?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's really what this next question is about. They want to know, this is from Roar Engen. So I'm sure I'm not saying that right, but that's what it appears to be. Roar wants to know what kind of lights we use for those sorts of things. Do you use a light for each print? Do you use different types of light? And I think this all stems from a conversation I had about – I've done several gallery shows, and I've actually pulled out of a few galleries where the lighting was just so bad that my photos looked like they sucked.
And your photos do not suck.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. Well, you've been in my studio, and you probably noticed that there are special spotlights on my ceiling pointing at each picture on the wall.
Yeah, and they're beautifully presented.
Yeah, that's the way I want to do it. And yes, I do buy special lights, and the brand changes from city to city wherever the show is. But the bottom line is that we want to try to approximate pure daylight as best as possible, because that's what we print for. Mm-hmm. So this conversation really needs to start with, what are you printing for? What are you showing for? If you're making prints that you're going to look at in your yellowish lighting in your office – and they look best in that lighting, then make sure that the lighting they're presented to the public in is also yellow. But if you work in a daylight balanced environment like I do, then you want to make sure that the prints, once they've been color managed for that, look that way to the viewer. And so there are daylight balanced bulbs, which is what we use for that purpose. So that's, I can't recommend a specific brand because, frankly, they go in and out of business so often and the model numbers change. It's like point-and-shoot cameras. Here's the Panasonic XBY-237-A.9 camera. But I can just say, look for a light that is the color that matches the color you work in. Now, Tamara, do you do a color managed workflow?
I do.
And how do you manage that workflow?
We just ran some X-Rite products across it. They just sent us a whole thing. You're talking about digitally, right?
Right. We're not, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay. I didn't know we were still talking about large fruit in the kitchen or we actually just ran, I've done the Color Monkey. And what was the other one? We just did it. I'm looking around my studio right now because I actually had my associate run it and set us all up. It was a little guy that you hang from the screen and it locks on there and sucks all your color together.
Okay.
That's pretty much how I understood it.
All righty. I'm sure there's a product that does that, but I'm not. I use the X-Rite I1 display, which is their pro tool.
That's the one.
Okay.
It looks like a little bookmarker. It sucks onto your thing and goes.
Well, they all do that. That's called a colorimeter. That would be the technical name for that.
But, boring.
In any event, if you're doing that and you're making prints in a certain color of light, my main point for this thing that we've sort of gotten off topic on is that you want to make sure that the prints match the light you're color proofing in. That's the big deal. So,
yep.
Because if you don't, it won't look in the gallery the way it looks in your studio, and you'll be disappointed.
Right. Even our we learned the very long way that in our studio we have a back room that's set up just for production. And we had it painted this lovely color that was very attractive to walk into, but it was like, it's kind of a chocolate brown that gave a little pink cast to all our black and whites. And it took a while before we were like, you know, oh, walk out into the daylight. It looks perfect. In the back room, we're like, there is a pink cast on this. Call the lab.
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, we could do days and days just on color management. Color management can be tricky if you don't know some of the pitfalls. One of my first studios, I had a giant Jimi Hendrix poster on my wall that was big and red. And that just influenced everything I saw when I was looking at my monitor, which was a few feet away.
I know. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Did you right away?
I figured it out pretty quick, yeah. And then we just made a rule. We painted all the walls flat gray and went to daylight color balanced lighting. And then we started using some tricks I saw at a tour. I took a tour of Industrial Light and Magic, where they do all the special effects for Spielberg and all those kind of people. George Lucas, actually, sorry. And they just had a little like children's nightlight behind the monitor as the sole light source at every station. And that was so that the colors of the surrounding areas didn't impugn the artist's ability to see the image the way it was going to look. Because when you're working on frames and frames of stuff that's going to be compiled with other people's frames and frames of stuff, you don't want the cartoonish character's skin to be different colors from shot to shot.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing, interesting thing too, is if you are setting everything up and your monitor is perfect, to recognize that your print will never look like your monitor.
Yeah, it's I say this all the time. Color management is not about perfect color; it's about consistent color. There's a difference.
Yes, agreed.
So if you use a color managed system whereby you've used a colorimeter and you've got profiles and you're working with ICC profiles and you're working to printers that you know what everything's right the way it's supposed to be, if the image is too blue, every image will be too blue, and that's what you end up with in color managed systems, unless you're getting into the $1 million systems, and pretty sure that X-Rite doesn't make any of those.
No, I think you just take it out of the box, you throw the pro thing down, and you hit go.
Yeah. Now, where it really gets ugly is when you're doing work for a book. Tamara was nice enough to submit her great photographs to be in my new book, Going Pro with Skip Cohen, and we had to do CMYK conversions. And let me tell you, you just don't know pain until you've done CMYK conversions.
Oh, I know. I agree.
Because it looks really underbar in RGB.
Yeah, and your book looks underbar.
Well, thank you. That's because I personally did each and every one of the CMYK conversions.
Well, thank you.
If I trusted it to the little guys at the print shop, it would not have looked the same.
The little guys. The
For some funny. Reason, I met them, and they're all like 4 feet tall. I don't know why.
they're hobbits.
There's the hobbits.
There they are.
All right, let's get another question in here real quick, and I know that you can help with this one, Tamara. This one is from Susan Coppell or Coppel. I have a question. I've been experimenting with some more dramatic lighting that's currently popular. This seems to work great if your model's 19 years old and has perfect skin, but it looks awful on older, say 40 to 60 non-models without perfect skin. What kind of lighting would you recommend that's flattering to middle-aged people but still retains some depth and perspective? Well, first of all, Susan, I only photograph good-looking 19-year-olds. That's the best way around this problem. Just kidding.
Good thing I just turned 19.
Yeah. Tamara, what would you suggest that might help Susan?
You know, one of the more interesting things I see is obviously to do more of a dramatic lighting, I think you need to step back a little bit and look at your overall lighting setup as opposed to what light do I put right on them. You know, that's one thing I've seen that's been very interesting. I think a lot of depth in modeling comes from, first of all, making sure you have the proper perspective in terms of what lens you're shooting with, how close you are, recognizing that you need a certain distance, you know, obviously from the subject, and you're separating your subject from the background so that you can properly use a hair light. And when I say properly, I mean, you're lighting the hair and the back, and you're not spilling over into the front, and just keeping all those things in mind, because that has a big effect before you start even getting to the idea of, okay, let me get some dramatic lighting. And with that, I have found that I'm able to do a lot with simply how I use my fill. In addition, I use a fill light on everything I shoot. And sometimes with little tiny babies and stuff, I want to be just broad and flat and just fill. And other times I want a bit more of a dramatic look and more, you know, sharply lit and finely modeled. And I can make a huge difference based on how I'm using the fill. And that means how close and how far back and how dark and how sharp. So, you know, I think there's a lot there, but I think it all starts with what is the overall lighting setup as opposed to where do I want to shine this light? Do you know what I mean?
I think that makes sense. Yeah, I'll just add to that a little bit and say it's important to understand the role that lighting plays in the shot. And it's pretty simple, you know, light illuminates and shadow defines. So when you're looking at quote unquote dramatic lighting, usually I like to start with the shadows. What do you think of that?
I think you're crazy. You're a rebel.
I am. I can't help it. But actually, I think I'm saying the same thing you were saying.
No, I do hear what you're saying. I think the other thing too, I think the other part of that question was about skin and lighting flatteringly. And obviously, that has to do with a broad close light. A wide close light is going to be more flattering, and especially a softer light. But but then making sure that you're using your shadows to create the depth you need.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that's part of what she was looking for, he was looking for. I hope so. We're going to take one more question before we wrap up with Tamara Lackey. I do want to thank BorrowLenses.com. They're back with us in 2012. Great place to borrow your next camera lens or whatever. They've got a RED camera for rent now. They've gone way beyond just, hey, you got that 70-200? If you can think of it, they've probably got it. So it's a great way to test gear before you buy or just get something for that once-in-a-lifetime shoot. For instance, if you go to Bosque del Apache next Thanksgiving to shoot, because that's where I get all the birds I shoot down there, and you never use an 800-millimeter lens except for that one day, doesn't make sense to spend $15,000 to buy one. Just rent it. And Borrow Lenses is a great place to do that. Let's see. This last question is Mr. Born and Guest. Back in the film days, a 50-millimeter 1.4 lens was kind of the standard kit lens. Today, the same lens is on the lower side of pricey, and back in the day, they were the kit. My question is, how do the 51.4 lenses of the day compare to the ones of yesteryear? Do you have an opinion on this, Tamara?
I don't know that I would be experienced enough in yesteryear.
It was a trick question just to see if we could get you to admit your real age.
19 and a half. I probably couldn't answer that because I haven't really worked with any kind of vintage lenses or anything. I know that the 51.4 of today is actually significantly cheaper than the 51.2 and not as inferior as the price would suggest in that regards.
I can answer this question with perspective,
having
purchased lenses, no doubt, before you were even a thought in your father's eye, Tamara. I can tell you that the lenses today are 52 kabillion times better than the old lenses in general. Yeah. Now, no need for the pedants in the audience to say, yeah, well, what about the 1930s? I get that there are a couple of great lenses from the old days, but in general, almost every, and I'm not just talking mere majority 51%, I'm like in the 90%, 95% range. All the lenses today, the technology behind their manufacture and their design is far superior to what we used to get. And all you have to do to prove that out is particularly to look at zooms. It's really evident there. You know, even a casual novice sees it there. But the 50s that we used to have were not as bright, were not typically as sharp as some of the new ones that we see, even in the $100 range, based on my test. Now, I can't speak to any specific lens comparison between this and that, but the question was asked in sort of a general way, and that's the way I'm going to answer it.
Excellent.
Okay. Tamara, it's always great to have you on the show. When you're not on the show, where can people find you?
TamaraLackey.com and on Twitter, Tamara Lackey.
And I highly recommend that everybody visit both sites to find out more about you. Just a quick reminder, if you want to interact with us, you can send us email at photofocus@me.com. The show is the 5th, the 15th, and the 25th of the month. And we are going to stop doing the podcast this year. We're going to make that announcement on the show. We've made it already on the blog. The blog is going to continue, and we've got a Flickr site, and we've got the Twitter stream. We're going to be adding more how-to videos and instructional screencasts on the photofocus.com site, which means we're going to be taking off the podcast sometime this spring. But for now, we're still here, 5th, 15th, and the 25th. Photofocus.com is updated every day. And we look forward to hearing from you at photofocus@me.com. And that's the end of today's show. We'll be back in 10 days. Remember what I always say, go out there and make pictures. Don't just take pictures. We'll see you on the next Photofocus.